Well, good morning, everyone, and welcome to This Week with Dr. T, our weekly news program. It's so good to see everyone here today. I want to start with a special announcement. As you know, we started our 10 Penny Prime membership this year at the beginning of January, and it's been going really, really well. There's three educational programs for fresh content, only for our members only, a topical white paper, a recorded PowerPoint presentation, and then a live call with the Ask the Expert towards the end of the month. These are all part of your membership. If you are already an existing member, you don't need to do anything. You can just go to dr10penny.com, click under the membership tab, and log in and see all of your benefits that are there. If you're new to us and you want to support what we're doing, you go to shop10penny.net. Right when the page opens up at the top, there's a membership tab. You can click on the membership tab. It will tell you what all of your benefits are and give you the option to join us on a monthly or on an annual basis. Your monthly support is what allows us to do all this content. We do 10 pieces of content a week. We do 2 to 3 newsletters a week. I do a lot of speaking and a lot of free events. And so that allows us to continue to keep our business going and to serve you as in our best possible way with as much content as we can provide. We have a big mix of free and paid membership content this year. So when you join us, we're trying to make 2025 be the year of knowledge, empowerment, and action. So thank you so much for your continued support. And if you're not a member, we hope that you'll join us soon. So before I introduce to you today's special guest, Scott Miller, to talk about his new book, The Most Dangerous Man in Washington, we're going to take a real quick break. Scott and I have had similar paths. I think this will be a really interesting conversation. You won't want to miss this. We'll be right back. Zeolite is a detox spray. We work specifically with a company called Touchstone Essentials. They are an incredible company. We've been working with them now for several years. And zeolite is a mineral that goes through your body like a one-way basket. It will clean out heavy metals such as arsenic and mercury, aluminum, cadmium, and it hooks onto those metals from a one-way perspective. So once it's bound, it goes out through your urine or your stools and doesn't get redeposited in other places. Everybody needs to have a detox product in their life, and this one is so easy to use, and it's so safe. You can take it when you're pregnant. You can take it when you're nursing. You can give it to little children. You can even give it to infants, and quite frankly, I give it to my dog. I actually put a little bit of the zeolite in his water because until we all stop living in a toxic world, we all need to get some of those extra toxicities out, the heavy metals, the persistent organic pollutants, the things that are floating through the air, the different things that we come in touch within our environment. And we are a big fan of zeolite from Touchstone Essentials. We've been a big, big, big fan of their products for several years. Go to dr10penny.com/detox to get your first bottle of zeolite spray for $50 off. Welcome back, everyone. So Scott had initial success treating COVID-19 patients using breathing treatments and he began spreading the word. And soon he became known as the only provider in Washington State in his area that was willing to help both children and adults through COVID. He learned early that sending a patient to the hospital was a death sentence. The first 4 patients that he sent to the hospital with COVID all died. So it became a mission of his to keep people out of the hospital and to treat them at home and in through his clinic. He eventually became an advocate in helping people escape from the hospital. And those of you that follow me over the last 5 years, you know we've had lots of conversations about that. His troubles began after he spoke at a medical freedom rally at the state capitol in Olympia, Washington in May of 2020, which resulted in over 150 complaints against him to the Washington Medical Commission. One of the patients who reported him for not wearing a mask, only one patient reported him for not wearing a mask, and no actual patient complained, and no patients were harmed. Sounds familiar, doesn't it? In October 12th of 2021, his license was temporarily suspended because he was accused of spreading misinformation and violating the standard of care. When the Washington Medical Council then asked him to undergo an inpatient neuropsychiatric evaluation, I got one of those letters also, and to pay them $30,000, which I got one of those letters too. So Scott, welcome to This Week with Dr. T. We certainly have a lot in common. As you know, I was one of the disinformation dozen. They wanted me to do a psychiatric evaluation and pay them money. My license was suspended. I fought back over 2 years to get it back. And when they voted to reinstate it, there were 11 members on the committee. 2 abstained from the vote and 2 voted no. Even though I'd had no complaints, 2 voted no to continue to punish me. They dragged me through the media in the mud. I gave over 600 presentations during that period of time. So welcome to the show. And I'm really looking forward to hearing your story of all the things that happened to you.
It's a pleasure. It's an honor to be here and to talk with you. When I think about it, it's actually a fairly small community of people that, you know, when you know pretty much all the names, that's a problem. And so, right. Cause it's true. There aren't that many. There are people that will help that are, you know, under the table, but as far as people that have been willing to actually, you know, what I would consider like aggressively speak out, that they're few and far between. And there's a reason why. The consequences are, you have to have some pretty thick skin.
Yeah, you do really have to have some really thick skin. So in your book, you start out by telling a story about a plane crash in which your father, who was a dentist, died. And that really impacted your whole life and your career choices. So tell us about that, and why did you choose to start there with your story?
It's a good question. I actually had that later in the book. I think that growing up, our parents were pretty good about showing us or giving us a lot of broad experiences. And one of the things that we did was dental mission trips. And there was one specific moment. We were in Peru, in this village, and people had come from, walked, 10, 15 miles to be there. It was the second day. They'd stayed in the courtyard. So it's just filled with people. And one night my dad told me, you have to go pick, I can see 5 more patients. And, I get to the door, we had it in our interpreter, and it's filled with people, moms holding their kids, begging to be seen. And I had to pick 5, and it just broke my heart. I think about it, it's just crushing. And just something about that just kind of stuck with me. And it, I guess when I thought about, all of the patient people are like, you can't take care of everyone. You can't handle all these calls. You can't keep going. You can't go to every sick person's home. Yeah. And I'm like, well, why not? Right. If I stay up long enough, if I, let's say, and when I get too tired or that I literally couldn't take another call, and I'd be like, okay, Lord, no more, please. It's enough. And there'd be a 2 or 3 minute break and my phone would ring again. I'm like, come on. But I would answer it. And somebody on the other end is barely able to speak. They couldn't breathe. And, and I'm talking after being up for 60, 65 hours straight with maybe, a 4 or 5 hour session of sleep in between doing a 70 hour straight, and my wife would knock me out with some Benadryl or hydroxyzine. So I would sleep for, 5 or 6 hours sometimes. People are like, how did you do it? I didn't. I mean, it was just like God picking me up and caring, because there's no way that the physical demands, the emotional demands, the mental demands, the just from a medical standpoint, these were already complicated adults, often elderly. And my training was pediatric. So I had to learn on the fly how to navigate and negotiate, that whole aspect. And so, but telling that story, because it was so impactful on me, and thinking about his death and the permanence of it and losing him at 19, and I watched so many people's families be completely torn apart and destroyed by this. Somebody walks into the hospital and never comes out. And it's just, I looked at it where it's like, how much does one life matter? I mean, it should matter a lot. Like, what should we do to protect and preserve the sanctity of that life? Everything, everything can't. Like there's no call that's less important. There's no, acutely ill patient that doesn't deserve maximum care. Because I know what that loss is like, and I just didn't. I wanted to prevent that for as many families as possible.
You know, you start out the storytelling, in your book talking about studying to go to medical school, or started studying to go to dental school. And then you had a really life-changing motorcycle accident. And then you decided to become a physician's assistant. What was the transition in that story? How did you get from being in dental school and then really couldn't go on to be a dentist because you had some really damage to your hand some structural problems. How did you decide to become a PA?
Want this to come across wrong, but a good friend of mine was finishing his surgical residency, and he had asked me, like, have you considered going to medical school? I'm like, dude, I just finished all of the didactic portion. It's like we just got through the thing that you would never want to have to do again. Like, I don't know that I could go back and do it. And he said, well, you should think about going to PA school. And I'm like, what is that? He said, physician assistant. I'm like, I don't know what that is. And so he told me a little bit about it, and that he had learned all of his, he'd go up to Lake Arrowhead and he learned all of his burn medicine from a PA there, and his cardiac from a PA that worked in the cardiothoracic, in at the Loma Linda Hospital in cardiothoracic surgery. And I just thought, wow, like no less. It's just 2 years, first year didactic, second year, you're basically, it's all spent doing clinicals. And so I'm like, I can do that. That's very doable. And I looked at the curriculum and I'm like, I've already done that. So it should be fairly straightforward. So I guess because I'm lazy, I don't like hard work.
I've often said, I think it would be interesting to go back to medical school now. I mean, me, after being in practice for 40 years, that it would be interesting to go back to and do those basic science courses again, and be able to do it really easily, because it's not primary learning. You already know most of the information, but you could go back and go like with a fine tooth comb, and you could learn things from a little different perspective and be able to ask better questions. When the first time going through, it was all just rote memorization. You just had like drinking from a fire hose, and you just had to take it all in. And wouldn't it be cool if you had the time to go back and redo the basic sciences from a position of knowing, and to really, really understand it from a little bit different? I think I've talked about that for years. It'll never happen in my life, but I always thought that would be kind of
fun. Well, you would get expelled.
Oh, for asking questions.
You'd be challenging the entire, when I had, so I was a preceptor. So I had students, nurse practitioner and PA students with me all the time. I mean, from 6 weeks, 6 weeks, 6 weeks, and through COVID, that became a little interesting and a little dicey. But I would ask them, like, what is your school's take on COVID, on treatments, on the origin? It was like, and it kind of, their minds kind of melted a little bit, because they were shocked that I would go and take care of, like, we'd test somebody and they would be positive and they were pretty sick, and I'd be like, all right, here's what we're going to do to treat, and and they would be there for, usually the follow-up would be, just over the phone, and they'd be like, yeah, I'm better, like 2 days later and their symptoms are gone. And then I would just give everybody in the clinic ivermectin, hydroxychloroquine, make sure we kicked up their, like vitamin D, et cetera. So they're watching these people get better right away, yet they're going to school where they're told there is no treatment. And so, like all of the things that they're seeing happen in front of them. And it was really hard to get them to even believe. I mean, crazy that they're like, well, is it really, was it the treatment, right? Was it, well, yeah. And I'd have them read the literature on it, and they would, the indoctrination is so complete that it's scary.
Yeah, that is really scary. I've heard that from other practitioners. What was your draw to draw you into being a pediatric PA? And then, of course, you ended up also treating adults through all the COVID things. What was your draw to go into being to focus on pediatrics?
I'd done my preceptorship in Central California at a clinic, and they had two part-time pediatricians. I was planning on doing adult medicine, and when I graduated, I was hired at kind of a sister clinic, and they wanted me to start the like a program for primary care. When I got there, apparently that wasn't their intention. It was like day one, and I had 25, pediatric patients on my schedule, newborns. And I had no idea what I was doing. I've never done a newborn exam. I'm like, this is, why would anyone want to do pediatrics? This is horrible. I just sat in there asking questions, and I would leave and go Google it. I didn't know anything that I was doing. It was a nightmare. And I got to the point after the second day, I'm like, this is kind of dangerous. So I asked the office manager, and I talked to one of the pediatricians. I said, can I shadow you and just shadow you for like a week or two and take home chart notes? So I'd take a stack of 50 charts home, and I'd go cover to cover, just trying to get an idea of the how you think through. And it didn't take very long where A, I love kids. But once I found that I could actually be a benefit instead of just guessing or making stuff up, it grew on me quite quickly. And I, you know, the idea of having to switch and do both primary care and without having that focus on pediatrics, I felt like I would be missing out on so much that I could learn and glean from having. His name was Dr. Restrepo, Santiago Restrepo. Just the learning that I was able to do from him, and he was a phenomenal teacher. And I thought, what a great, almost like a fellowship in pediatrics. And I fell in love, and I'm like, this is what I'm going to do the rest of my life.
That's pretty cool. Well, the title of your book is The Most Dangerous Man in Washington. How did you get that title? What is it that you got that title?
You know, it's I was looking through paperwork because I but they used the attorneys general, the Washington Medical Commission, the state's expert medical witness, used that phrase so frequently throughout their statements of charges and letters of cooperation, statements of charges, indictments, things like that. They just kept saying how dangerous. So they said that I was using my status of my position and my license to to misinform that what I was doing was misinforming people in the in our county in the state, that I was disrupting the relationship between the community and the hospitals. Because when I gave a lecture right 2 days before my suspension, where I was telling him exactly what was going on in the hospitals. And I'd recorded almost every phone call I had with the hospitals, with the doctors. And so I played some recordings for some people where they're, I mean, shocked. Unless you're on the phone and you hear I don't want to say almost a cyborg-like lack of humanity that we were dealing with, a complete inflexibility. I'll really quick on this story. So I sent a woman to the hospital, 77-year-old. She lived on her own, and I found out that she ended up having some vomiting, so she wasn't taking any of the meds. And she woke up and she had this kind of sharp pain in her back and her chest. So I wanted to make sure she wasn't clotting. So I sent her to the hospital to get imaging and lab workup. And when I told her she needed to go, she started crying, and she's like, I don't want to go to the hospital. That's where people go to die. I was like, wow, no, you're fine. Like, I'm not sending you to get admitted. We just need to get some labs. We need to check, D-dimer and imaging. I'm like, don't worry, I'll take care of you. Like, I promise you, nothing's going to happen to you. And she goes, I trust you. And so she went to the hospital, and I found out later that afternoon that they encouraged her to stay for observation and put her on oxygen, then started cranking her oxygen up to a point where it was at a level that she couldn't go home. And she had declined mechanical ventilation. So they, and so a week her son and I spent almost begging the pulmonologist, the intensivist, to do something. We finally got them to move the needle from 6 milligrams of dexamethasone to 125 of solumedrol. And we're like, oh, we've got a chance. Like, she's got a chance. And then they wouldn't put her on antibiotics, even though her white cell count was going up. So they had ordered that. And the new intensivist that came in told us that the infectious disease doctor said that it was too dangerous to put her on that, on the solumedrol, and that she didn't need antibiotics. But they would put her on comfort care. And so they put her on comfort care and she died. And fortunately, the son recorded, I had him record it because Washington State is a two-party state and he was in a one-party state. And, you know, I sent some of those recordings out, sent some things to Project Veritas, to some other media outlets. So anyways, so I just thought it was so important for people to understand how dangerous it was. If you find yourself in a hospital, if you don't, you can't have an, you couldn't have an advocate for yourself. You know, you could decline remdesivir, you could decline mechanical ventilation, but they're still going to do everything they can to facilitate your demise. And so I was trying to educate as many people in the community as I could. So I spoke out quite a bit. You know, they said that I was, you know, what I was doing was harming people. I was harming, perpetuating the spread of a deadly virus during a worldwide pandemic, and that I was too dangerous to be able to practice, and, you know, use my license or credentials to lie to people, moral turpitude, you know, practicing below the standard of care. So I guess they thought that if they suspended my license, it would shut me up. So, and I'm like, that's the only thing that you have over me that's keeping me sort of contained.
How did you, were you writing blogs or doing things on the radio or doing things with podcast interviews? How were you getting disseminating this information that they decided to say that you were dangerous and needed to have your license suspended?
So I'd like community talks, some interviews that were published throughout the, you know, Clark County, throughout Southwest Vancouver or Southwest Washington. I was on a number of Facebook groups that had, you know, like thousands of parents, because we were trying to, I was, my focus was trying to get the schools open, reopening our schools. So I was posting, I mean, it, almost like books on what I was experiencing in my practice with the depression and anxiety that I was seeing in the kids from the isolation. I mean, it was just, it was devastating. It was something I couldn't fix because, you know, what was being disseminated at their schools, just in general, is like, these kids are vectors of death. You know, everything has been stripped from them, and then they create this whole fear thing. So I was really vocal about trying to get our schools open. So, oh, that was the other thing. Sorry. So I had written thousands of mask exemptions, and I was one of the only ones that would do a medical exemption for the COVID vaccine, COVID shots, and not realizing it, I came to find out later on that every one of those that I signed was just like a bullseye on me. So it was a, quite a few things. But most of the time it was either publicly speaking or speaking at churches or articles written.
So the school system probably came after you also, didn't they?
Oh yeah. Oh yeah. They did. Oh my gosh, they didn't. Well, and the whole critical race theory was being really pushed, and you know, LGBTQ critical race. And so I was, you know, I'm not a fan of indoctrinating our children, and parents don't even, you know, parents didn't even really know what was being taught in the school. So I was trying to make people very aware of that. And I had a campaign to have parents unenroll their children, period. Like, just like not do distance learning, just remove your children from the system. So yeah, there is, I had my hand in a number of what was considered controversial areas.
But did you have, were you, and I'm not sure exactly where Clark County is in Washington State. Where is that located?
Directly over the river from Portland, Oregon.
Oh, so it's south.
Yeah.
Very south.
Yeah, we're right on the other side of the Columbia. I mean, you can, yeah, Portland Airport is right across the river.
Were you the sole person standing up against the powers that be at that time? Were you like kind of the Lone Ranger?
There were whispers of other that, like, there was a clinic about an hour from us that was caring for patients that they weren't vocal about it, but enough that we had heard of them. And there was, you know, a couple where they were doing some treatments. There were naturopaths that I later met that were doing treatments. I was the only one that I know of that was actively speaking out against what I was seeing, and just letting them know that there are treatments, for crying out loud. I mean, that was the biggest thing. People were calling from all over the country. I mean, day and night, just asking for help. So, yeah, I'm trying to think. It's like, when I say a small group, until, like, I was the only one I know of until around October of 21.
Yeah, I think that there were, you know, across the country, I've spoken to a lot of doctors and practitioners over the last 5 years. Can you believe it's been 5 years since
I cannot.
Me neither. It's like, where did that time go? It still seems like it was maybe 6 months ago. You know, it's been 5 years. And I've spoken to a lot of practitioners, as you can imagine, either in person or on my podcast, or me being on their podcast. And there were little pockets of people that were just doctors that were just shaking their heads, said, this just can't be. I mean, we've got budesonide, we've got hydroxychloroquine, we've got ivermectin. There was a study that came out really, really early in, I'm going to say March of 2020, may have been March or April. It was very early when all this COVID stuff broke loose. It was a study that was published. There was a guy who was a PharmD, who has a, for the listener, it's a PhD in pharmacology. He was a pharmacist that had a PhD. And he had access to, like, drug databases. And he put together a group of like 50 or 60 scientists all over the world. And what they did was they combed the literature. They went through every drug. They went through everything just to see if there was anything out there that would help with these symptoms. And they came up with a list of something like 30 or 40 already FDA approved medications and already approved in other countries around the world. So they didn't have to go through an approval process, that because of the way that COVID worked and the types of symptoms that people had, that they thought the off-label use of these medications could help some people. And that study was absolutely buried. I mean, it was stripped off the internet. It was absolutely buried because the powers that be didn't want anybody helped. In fact, they, you know, to make it even be released, to make the COVID jabs be released under the EUA, the Emergency Use Authorization, they had to break two federal laws to do it. They had to say that they knew that the drug was less toxic than the disease, which we know that it wasn't. The vaccine was not less toxic than the disease, and that there was no other available treatments to treat the illness. And so they had to break two laws. And, you know, I look back at this, Scott, I look back over the last 5 years and think the mountains of evidence against these people, mountains of evidence, death rate, the turbo cancers, the myocarditis, the death rate that continues to climb, even though the infection really isn't really out there much anymore. And yet nobody's gone to jail. The only people that have gone to jail or had any sort of legal problems are people like you and me.
Yeah.
And so are they still coming after you at this point in time?
They did up until, So we had to, as my wife calls it, as Shelley calls it, we had to bomb trap it across the country. So she grew up here. So it was still, so we got here in January of 2024. So in March, I got another letter from the state saying that I was in violation, even though I had shut everything down. And then again in April, and I finally was able to get a hold of somebody and told them, I don't know what to do here. Like, these are random complaints about a website that I have. I'm not cracked. And about 6 weeks later, and she said that she'd look into it and investigate. And I got a letter finally. It was saying, okay, yeah, we don't, there's no, we don't find any facts, factual basis on the complaint. But what's interesting is the process that should happen when there's a complaint is it's investigated. You look at it for the merits of the complaint, that never happened at all. Not one time was I contacted, it always went to what's called a letter of cooperation. They always opened up an investigation, the letters of cooperation. It was crazy. I mean, absolutely nuts. And at one point there was a question, do you use ivermectin to diagnose COVID-19? If so, we need chart notes for everyone that you've prescribed ivermectin from January of 2019 through like March of 2022. And I remember thinking that's a huge problem. I'd probably prescribe 4,000, right? 4,000, I probably had 4,000 people at that time. This was in August of 21, and I'm like, how am I going to get those chart notes and what are they going to do with it? And I'm freaking out. And then I looked at the question. I was like, do you use ivermectin to diagnose COVID-19? So I just wrote, no, I don't use it to diagnose COVID-19. And it was like each time they asked these questions, it was like the Tower of Babel. It's like God struck them dumb because there was always an out, because my whole thing is I'm not going to lie, but I didn't have to because of the way they asked it. And one of my attorneys was like, well, Scott, don't you have to give an explanation? I was like, no, it's like, if somebody's like, hey, are you into rape? And I said, no, let me give you some reasons why, right? Like, you would never do that. Like, not my thing, right? Like, if I have to explain the why, that's a problem. So they considered what I was doing obstructing their investigations, just the way, and I mean, it's shocking looking back. But, it was interesting as I was, and you and I talked about the book, and thank you again for the innumerable ways that I can make it good. There's, and I'm positive that you were like that, where, you really are on an island, and it's like, there's nobody, for me, there was no one I could talk to. My wife was like, she was a nurse, but she wanted some plausible deniability for some of the stuff that I was doing. Cause we were getting into, I mean, when I say I was willing to do whatever it took to protect kids from having to get the shot or going, having whatever, not being able to go back to college, that was the hill I was willing to die on. And I was starting to push some boundaries that even I was getting uncomfortable with.
Such as what?
Well, you couldn't enter it historically. You could not go into the immunization database and enter it historically. So the only way you could do that is if you were a preferred or a designated Pfizer, Moderna vaccination site. So I became a designated Pfizer vaccination site.
Yeah, I've heard other people that have done the same thing in order to, and even though they weren't administering the vaccine, they did it because they wanted to know they wanted firsthand information, as if they were part of the club when really they weren't. So this is a good place. We need to take a really quick break. We're a little bit behind schedule here, but we're going to take a really quick break. Today, we're talking to Scott Miller, who's a pediatric PA and author of The Most Dangerous Man in Washington, a really compelling story that is getting out there about what happened to him, which was representative of what happened to many of us. Hold that thought. We'll be right back. We also have an apparel line on our store that has just the best things. In fact, I go and shop at my own store. I mean, I really do go and buy stuff out of my own store. They have t-shirts and sweatshirts and cups and mugs and totes. We've got a great designer. We're always adding new things all the time. And either one of those two product lines, either our private label supplements, our Opti line, the white bottles with the green leaves on it, or with the apparel store, and they're two separate stores. They do not have a single shopping cart. It's like you go in one store and get your groceries and you go to the other store and get your shoes. Well, these are two separate stores, but you can use the same affiliate code. If you use the code podcast, when you go to the checkout, you can get 10% off on everything you buy every time you go to the store. Well, welcome back, everyone. You know, Scott, you said in your book, one of the things you said is, what are you willing to do to honor the legacy of your amazing spouses, partners, and family members who have been so cruelly taken from you? And now that we have 5 years and the death rate is continuing to climb, I mean, my assistant has lost five people since the first of the year, since January of this year. One of my business partners in one of the businesses that I have, he has lost over 200 people that have died from the COVID jab. He told me when he got to 175, he was going to quit counting, but he didn't. And a few weeks ago, he said, well, I'm now at 203 people, of people that I know, or spouses of people I know, or friends of a friend, because he has very large circles of the people that he's involved with. And we're continuing to see, and there was a paper that came out maybe 6 weeks ago now that even said that up to 15 years after your last COVID job, up to 15 years, you still have a risk of sudden death. So with that in mind and what people are doing for their legacy, for their amazing spouses, and I know that you're a Christian man and that you put a lot of thought into that, what are some of the memories now that you think that people can do for the people that have passed?
I'll say that what I've found just personally, it's that in talking to so many widow and widowers that are, they're still almost living on their hate. Mm. I'm in a COVID widow. I was invited into a COVID widowers group so that I just, because I would counsel a lot of them privately because they were in such dark places. And, I think that to me, what would be most beneficial for me would be finding productive ways to honor their legacy. So for my friend Catherine, who lost her husband, she started that group. She had started going to the state legislators to try and, you know, get these protocols to stop, to get information out, to get truth out. Because I've had situations happen where I felt that way, where I was living on anger, I was living on hate, and it's such a destructive, dark place to be. When you turn that into something that's purposeful, if you're not living with purpose, if you're not, because we all have our talents, right? And if we have a serious conversation and we let the Holy Spirit in, and because if somebody says, "Well, I don't have any," well, you have to, because you're a brother or sister in God, so you have to have talents. He wouldn't have given you no talent. Let's diligently search for those and then go serve humanity with those talents that you've been given. Take that purpose and just like make your sphere around you a better place.
Well, you know, the Bible says all things work together for those who love the Lord. All things. That means good and bad things, not just good things. And it's only, you know, God calls those things, you know, and we put an adjective on them and call them either good or bad, but to God, they're just things. And so, you know, those, whatever those things are that happened, that were destructive, that were literally deadly, that were all these different things. If you can think about a way, like you said, to turn it into something of benefit, starting a support group, supporting, you know, the spouse that you lost, if they had a particular hobby, going and supporting that hobby in their name and different things. So you're right. It's like turning that hate into something productive. I think that's really good advice.
Well, and but this is towards the end of book one. That woman that I lost. I mean, I was, when I say angry, I was, it was bad. Except, there was, I had to, it took me a little while. It took me a few hours just to kind of wrap my head around, the phone call that I got from her son. But during that time, there was a woman that she had taught English to the Chinese community. And this Chinese woman had reached out to the son and said that she was able to drop off like a Chinese herbal tea at the hospital and they would take it up to her. And I was like, what? They can do that? I didn't know they were allowing anything. And he said, yeah, they said they would do it. So I thought it'd be a good idea to have her come over to my house at like 11:30 at night and make her tea. And in the process of doing that, I would put some extra stuff in the tea, so that could go in and potentially help. Unfortunately, we were only allowed to do that one time. But I remember talking to her son probably 6 months after he died, after she died, his mom died. And I said, listen, I know this isn't a consolation, and I'm still like, I still hurt for you. Even saying her name sometimes, it's like, oh, because of what we were able to do, what was revealed to us, your mom, and what we were able to do because of her. I probably was able to get, I mean, a couple hundred people that were either on the brink of, that were on the brink of being put on mechanical ventilation. We were able to get easily a couple hundred people out of the ICU and home to their families. Had it not been for that situation, had not been for, in the book I call her Charlotte, a lot of people would have died. And, it's, and he said, he's like, thank you for telling me that. I'm like, your mom's, and it's like, I've tried to be really delicate because she was my patient and I wasn't able to protect her. But I'm like, your mom's a hero. I mean, what she, like that whole situation and scenario. I mean, so even just for me looking at, sometimes we forget to see, there's so many miracles that happen in our daily lives and we just look at them as coincidences or he's like, well, that's cool. It's like, no, it's not cool. It's beautiful. It's not a coincidence. And that's just the, it's just seeing our creator engaging in our lives.
Absolutely. Well, Scott, today we've been talking with Scott Miller, a pediatric PA, who is the author of the book, The Most Dangerous Man in Washington. As we close out here, Scott, today, are you still considered the most dangerous man in Washington?
No, I had to leave.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, so they were going to put me in jail. So they're felony $10,000 and felony 5 years in jail, $10,000. So my attorneys were like, you need to leave now. I was like, oh, okay. So I had to shut my other, my wellness practice down. And then we just packed up and moved out to East Texas. So I'm no longer, it's interesting because I've gone back a couple times and went back for book signing and people are like, are you is anybody allowed to know that you're here? And I'm like, I don't think they're coming after me anymore. I mean, they should, I had people, they shot holes through my office window. I mean, we had death threats. My wife and kids had go bags. It was dicey. We was, yeah. So when I said the part two, and I start off the second book with the most hated man in Washington, because they had all these sites dedicated. It was like thousands and thousands of different articles in a PubMed, a med page, Medscape, Daily Beast, all these, but it was the, oh my gosh, the comments or websites that were put up just, hey, I hope you die. I hope you blanking die. I hope your family dies and your kids die. And when you're buried, we're going to come, desecrate your grave. And I was like, well, that seems a little excessive. And I actually, I wrote back to that dude and I was like, oh man, I love a family that has hobbies, like, but it was, there, my wife had to, had, there was a lot of, there was a big spiritual battle that we were taking on. And she, I mean, God bless her, probably one of the most resilient, amazing human beings ever. I mean, she's just the she like, if there's a physical manifestation of an angel, it's her. And,
Wow.
I mean, I can't tell you how many lives she saved. Because when I lost my license, that day I found out my license was suspended. I had a number of nurses that were volunteering, and it took a few hours to convert it. So, but by that afternoon, I converted my clinic into a monoclonal antibody infusion center. And she, I mean, she would go in and you know, have eight acutely ill people. I mean, these are people that are sadding in the, you know, high 60s, low 70s, you know, I mean, pretty sick, right? And an hour and a half later, they're walking around the lobby chit chatting, you know, and people are like, how? And so, you know, I had a few nurses that were just amazing, but I would watch her. She was a labor and delivery nurse. I would watch her walk in and just give these people hugs and get them set. I mean, I was watching her in that element. Just, you would think this is what she's been doing forever. And she was a little freaked out. I mean, these are really acutely ill. I mean, these are ICU level, you know, sicknesses. And yeah, people don't know. And a lot of people don't know how many lives she directly saved because of her courage.
Well, God bless you. Thank you so much for what you did, what you've been through. I'm looking forward to your second book coming out to talk about how hated you were and all the legal battles and everything that you went through. So as we close out today, I want to thank you, Scott, so much for being here with us. And a special thank to those who join us, our regular people who come here every week. We've been doing this now for almost 5 years. So we really appreciate your support. Thank you so much for joining us here today. And to our Tenpenny Prime members, we are forever grateful for your support. If you're not a member yet, you can go to shoptenpenny.net under the membership tab. Read about all the benefits that come along with membership. And we hope that you'll join us and support the work that we do. So with that, I want to close out with one of my favorite verses from the Bible. I close all my podcasts with, whether they are live or pre-recorded, which is Romans 12:12. Rejoice in hope, be patient in trouble, and be persistent in prayer. So until we see you here next week, same place, same time, lean into God, trust him for everything. He will never let you down. Scott, thank you so much again for your courage. Thank you for being here with us today. And to everyone else, have a great week, everybody. We'll see you on all the other broadcasts that we do all week. And remember that we post every single day on drtenpenny.substack.com. Yeah.
And I would encourage people to go on Amazon and check out the book.
Well, of course. Yeah, that's what we were here talking about. So, and the book's name is and your book's name is The Most Dangerous Man in Washington by Scott Miller.
Bye, so, it was a pleasure.
Thank you so much, everybody. So have a great week, everyone. Goodbye and God bless.
In a time when truth is censored, one name stands out. Dr. Sherry Tenpenny, the relentless seeker of knowledge and defender of freedom. Explore groundbreaking findings at drtenpenny.com. Ignite your mind with riveting podcasts, explosive articles, research-driven substacks, webinars, ebooks, and more. In an era plagued by environmental toxins and vaccine-related exposures, Dr. Tenpenny has expertly crafted a selection of safe detox protocols that facilitate profound healing at a cellular level. It's time to cleanse, rejuvenate, and restore your body vitality. With heart damage on the rise, Dr. Tenpenny introduces nationwide ECP therapy to repair hearts and achieve optimal health. Seize the opportunity and embrace the wealth of resources, information, and health recommendations awaiting you at drtenpenny.com and become a Tenpenny podcast member to join our mission in the quest for uncensored truth, the health of our nation, and medical freedom.